Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, journalist Alexander Salmon, reports that Romania is home to one of the largest and most important old-growth forests left in the world. Its mountain chain, which wraps like a seatbelt across the country's middle and upper shoulder, hosts at least half of Europe's remaining old growth outside Scandinavia and around 70% of the continent's virgin forest. It's been referred to as the Amazon of Europe, a comparison apt and ominous in equal measure because of the speed at which, like the Amazon itself, is disappearing. In 2015, the furniture giant IKEA bought 83,000 acres of forest in Romania. Within months, IKEA became and remains Romania's largest private landowner. IKEA is now the largest individual consumer of wood in the world, its appetite growing by 2 million trees a year. According to some estimates, it sources up to 10% of its wood from the relatively small country of Romania and has long enjoyed relationships with mills and manufacturers in the region. Joining us to discuss his New Republic investigation is Alexander Salmon. Alexander is a former reporter and researcher at the New Republic. He's now a staff writer at the American Prospect. And I hope you can take the time to read his lengthy piece and look at the photos. It's called IKEA's Race for the Last of Europe's Old Growth Forest. The furniture giant is hungry for Romania's famed trees and little stands in its way. Hi, Alexander. Thank you so much for your reporting on this and thanks for joining us.
Hey, yeah. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you put so much into this investigation. When did you first learn about what was happening in Romania and why did you decide to go so deep into this story?
Yeah, it's a long piece and a bit of a long story. I came into the story actually towards the tail end of 2019. I was reading the BBC and saw a news hit about a forest ranger who'd been murdered in Romania. Where I read the piece, it noted that was the second forest ranger to have been murdered out there in like a 6-week period, some very short timeline, which seemed pretty shocking to me for, you know, an EU member state to be having that kind of that degree of violence. Both murders were in conjunction with illegal logging. So I started kind of looking into it, just curious as to what exactly was going on there. And then one thing led to the next, and I found out kind of the IKEA connection and ended up being fodder for a much larger piece.
The history behind this is so interesting. As you report, most of Europe was rapidly deforested during the industrial era. Less than 4% of EU forest land remains intact. Romania, far enough from the continent's industrial centers and long a closed-off member of the Soviet bloc, remained a shining exception. So tell us what happened during the country's communist period.
Yeah, the communist period in Romania was interesting for its forest land, interesting for a lot of reasons, but for one reason, it isolated Romania and kept these forests off the global market. So there wasn't industrial logging at an international scale going on there. And so that meant that a lot of these forests remained basically protected. And that's part of the reason why you see so much old growth and virgin forest left in the country is there just wasn't, you know, it wasn't part of the global market. It wasn't part of, you know, a global export economy. And so those forests were publicly owned. They were publicly managed, and for that reason, you know, they remained relatively intact. And then in 1989, communism comes to a screeching halt in Romania. Ceausescu, the communist dictator of Romania, is actually assassinated, and quickly that changes, and Romania goes through a lot of political upheaval. There's a big campaign to privatize that forest land, which is rife with corruption and fraud. Romania ends up joining the EU, and around that same period that Romania joins the EU, the deforestation really takes off, and we see basically in a matter of like 15 years, a huge percentage of the forest, especially old growth spruce and old growth beech, begins to disappear. Same period of time during which big players like IKEA move in there. So obviously no coincidence, and it's a pretty startling tale from there on out.
It's incredible to think about how fast all of this happened. You write that according to a 2018 report initially suppressed by the Romanian government and leaked later that year, more than half of the country's timber is illegally harvested. I mean, to think that in the 80s and prior, it was for the most part untouched. And then 2018, half of the country's timber is illegally harvested.
Right. And it's a jarring number for a lot of reasons, one of which is that I think even the legal logging is not particularly curtailed. It's a legal logging too is an enterprise that's, you know, fairly rife with corruption. It's certainly very permissive out there, given the, you know, the kind of limited enforcement mechanism that exists. And despite that, something like 55% of logging on a yearly basis there is done illegally. So that the extraction is massive. It's widespread and it's at a, as you said, like a pretty shocking clip. And yeah, that report was very interesting because, right, the government had some sense that there was a lot of illegal logging going on. The numbers that they ended up producing were so huge that they actually were afraid to let those numbers get out. And eventually they did get out. And it gives you a sense of how grave things are.
We've done so many shows about fast fashion, and it was so interesting to read fast furniture in your piece. You write, add to all of this the astronomical growth of the fast furniture industry, which relies on the spruce and beech that populate these forests, and the result has been a delirium of deforestation. So for those who are maybe not familiar with the furniture industry and the rise of fast furniture, can you just give us an overview of what that looks like today?
Certainly, yeah. And IKEA is probably the most prominent member of this, you know, class of manufacturers, but there are others as well. It's something like Zynus or, you know, any of the, what, you know, the Wayfair producers. It's something of a revolution in consumer goods that you can now, you know, buy furniture for so cheap, and you can get it sent to you in this, you know, this orderly, flat packed manner, sent to your house or picked up and thrown in the back of your car, and you do at home assembly. That's obviously not how things always were. I mean, for a long time, people would buy furniture with the intention of keeping it for, you know, years or decades. But I think, you know, interestingly, as like, you know, housing prices have gone up and cost of living has gone up, one thing that's gone down really is the cost of furniture with the sort of innovation of this flat pack fast furniture that has made IKEA so popular. And the result of having a, you know, $25 wood chair is that wood has to come from somewhere. It has to come from somewhere very cheap. And the result of that is there's a ton of pressure on these forests to yield that wood and to do so very cheaply. And so places like Romania, where labor is relatively cheap, the enforcement mechanism is basically non-existent, end up being really fecund for logging, and for IKEA in particular, in this case, which has a huge presence in Romania specifically, but also in Eastern Europe and Russia broadly.
And then the amount of money that's being made, you write that the fast furniture industry is forecast to grow from $564 billion in 2020 to $850 billion by 2025, which is so, I mean, huge numbers. I'm sure a lot of people are looking around their room thinking, where did that desk come from? Or where did that table come from? And as you write, tracing any individual tree from forest floor to a showroom is almost impossible.
Right, right. And so, you know, I look around my own room here, and I am as guilty of this as anyone. The sort of, you know, cheap chipboard or particle board bed frame, or the folding chair, or the desktop, or whatever. The wood that goes into that, you know, we have some vague sense of where it might come from. We are kind of assured that it has come from a sustainable source. IKEA makes that a big part of its messaging strategy, that they have a, you know, a positive environmental story to tell. But it's hard to know. It's, you know, they're not going to tell you where the log came from. And oftentimes they don't even know really if it came from a legal source or an illegal source. It would take an incredible amount of surveillance and manpower to ensure the provenance of any one given log. And so oftentimes this wood is chipped up into particles and, you know, reconstituted effectively. So there are a lot of reasons why it's tough to know. But, you know, looking at this one country, this one sector, you have a sense that there's a lot of below board activity going on here.
Right. And just to spend a little more time on the supply chain, you explain this really well in your piece. The owners of a forest auction off its trees to be cut down by a logging company, after which the wood is taken to a depot and then sold to a mill that processes it into lumber, wood chips, or particle board, and then sold again to a manufacturer, which makes it into a chair or the pieces of a chair on behalf of furniture companies like IKEA, which then buy it, brand it, ship it, and sell it for at-home installation. I mean, that just kind of makes your head spin.
Right, right. And it's a complicated process. And it's part of the reason that it's so hard to trace this stuff is that you know, IKEA doesn't send a bunch of loggers out there in blue and yellow uniforms with the classic, you know, blue plastic bag to go cut the trees down and take them to the factory. It's a process where, you know, there are many actors, and you know that kind of goes through them. And IKEA happens to be at the end of that. So IKEA will contract with a manufacturer and say, we need you to make the pieces for 10,000 folding chairs. And that manufacturer will then go out and say, you know, we need 20,000 logs to make 10,000 folding chairs, and find a depot that will sell them 20,000 logs. And the depot does business with the logging company that says, you know, we have access to a forest that will produce 20,000 logs and we'll sell them to you on those grounds. And so, yeah, it's, you know, sort of classic subcontracting. It's the nature of the supply chain. In the case of furniture, you know, furniture creation, it's effectively a forestry enterprise. It's an extractive industry in a lot of ways at its base. And that's the way this particular one operates.
Let's spend some time talking about how IKEA bought its land. You tell this amazing story about how the Harvard University Endowment snatched up Romanian property after a post-communist land restitution law left an antique privatization system in its wake, handing over half of the country's public forest land to private interests. So you write, starting in 2004, the university, Harvard, using various shells and nonprofit formations, began buying big with the help of a Romanian businessman, Dragos Lipan. So tell us more about how this all happened.
Yeah, it's one of those stories. It's like almost stranger than fiction in some sense. But if you're willing to go back all the way, the land restitution program that I mentioned a little bit earlier was this plan to get the publicly held forests that were expropriated during the communist period back into the hands of private owners. Obviously, this program was rife with corruption. There, you know, weren't really records. There was very little oversight. And you hear, you know, in the process of my reporting, would hear these stories about, a Hungarian grandma in a retirement home who hires whose kids hire a lawyer on her behalf. And, you know, she's never even lived in Romania, but her last name is just kind of similar to someone who once did. And that can be enough to come away with thousands of hectares of forest land. And obviously, you make a claim on that. Those people aren't looking to hold it for the long haul. They don't intend to move back there and start killing the land. It's to make a quick buck. And so a lot of these ownership claims are made on pretty dubious grounds. And then they're sold quickly to investors. And in this case, one of the investors who's on the vanguard of this movement is the Harvard University Endowment, which is obviously a massive institutional investor. Is involved in all sorts of investment programs. And this happens to be one of them. They catch wind that they can get a huge holdings of land on the cheap. And in conjunction with this businessman who eventually gets a 3-year suspended sentence because the deals in relation to the deals themselves, the deals were obviously highly questionable. And, anyways, long story short, or not even that short, but Harvard ends up buying massively. And by, I think, the early 2000s, the endowment is actually the largest private landowner in Romania other than the church. And so, you know, they had this massive presence there. It's not without legal trouble. And there are lawsuits, a handful of them, over those purchases. And eventually Harvard decides it's not worth the trouble. They're going to wash their hands of this corruption-addled deal. And they end up selling themselves. And they sell to IKEA, who readily snaps up this land and much more, and becomes the largest private landowner in Romania, period, and remains that to this day.
What is the relationship like between IKEA and the Romanian government? Or I guess, what is the Romanian government like? And then what's that relationship like?
Well, importantly, the Romanian government is notorious in some sense for its, you know, both its corruption and its ineffectiveness. And that sounds harsh, but, you know, if you look at Transparency International, I think, is an international NGO that looks at corruption on a national scale, and rated Romania this year as the most corrupt country in Europe. It routinely ranks, you know, at the bottom or near the bottom of those rankings. And so you have a government that just isn't, you know, it both lacks the sort of structural integrity and the enforcement to really police these sorts of things. IKEA obviously is aware of this and they benefit from it in ways both directly and indirectly. You know, they, when they bought that land, they bought so with the, they did so with the understanding that, that the Romanian government was unlikely to give them a hard time about it or to make their life difficult. And, you know, that's part of the reason they were willing to make that purchase or make those purchases. And yeah, there's not a sense of, I don't think there's a serious sense of acrimony between the government and IKEA. It's been hard enough for the government there to even form a ruling coalition. And towards the end of 2021, they didn't even have an active government coalition in place. So it's, you know, sort of maybe to be expected, but there have been a lot of problems at various levels in terms of good governance for the Romanian state.
Today, we are speaking with Alexander Salmon about his New Republic piece called IKEA's Race for the Last of Europe's Old Growth Forest. The furniture giant is hungry for Romania's famed trees and little stands in its way. Alexander Salmon is a former reporter and researcher at the New Republic and is now a staff writer at the American Prospect. So we talked about how it's difficult to trace a tree from the forest floor to the showroom, and then about how this fast furniture industry is just exploding. Let's just talk a little bit about what actually happens in the forests, because you have some incredible stories about going out into the forest with various activists, with a film crew. First off, what is it like? I mean, tell us what it's like to be in an area that is full of protected old growth. What does that look like?
It's you know, it's a very striking experience. It's very beautiful. The sort of the thing about old growth forests that's so arresting when you're in them is the you have this incredibly dynamic ecosystem where you have old trees that are huge, you know, 300 to 500 years old routinely. You have new trees that are young and smaller. You know, down trees that are rotting. You have, you know, lichens and moss, and you have berries, and you know, these places are home to bears. They're home to all sorts of birds and other animals. And it's one of these. They're, you know, very lush and cool, and it's very striking to be in one of those forests because you know, you get to see so much life and how they can be home to incredible array of species. And you know, if you are so unlucky as to stumble upon something like a clear cut or even a replanted forest, one that's been cut and then, you know, planted again, you can tell right away that the difference in this sort of uniformity of the plants, a replanted forest, all the trees are effectively the same size. They're because they're the same age. Oftentimes they're blighted with, you know, bark beetle or any series of maladies because they're all vulnerable to the same sorts of things. And even then you'll have the trees sometimes are much more tightly packed because they've been planted basically in a grid formation. So compared to the old growth forest, it's very, very different. And, you know, it's something that's, you know, in my reporting, I felt kind of lucky even to see what these look like because they're, you know, there's so few of them left in the world and especially in temperate climates and, you know, fairly accessible places.
I bet. And again, I hope people can check out your piece because there's some incredible images, drone images photographed in 2021 that show logging in an old growth forest in Romania. And you can find that link at yourcallradio.org. So these are incredible forests. And as you write, it's really up to activists to protect them. With so little former law enforcement, Romania's Forest Guard was chartered in 2015 as a 617-person unit that doesn't work nights or weekends. So the task of protecting the forest has really fallen on activists and volunteers, and this is very dangerous work.
It is. Yeah, it is. And that's, yeah, getting back to kind of that earlier point that we were talking about, it's proven to be extremely dangerous, it's proven to be deadly for some. And you know, especially as more attention has come to the illegality, as more pressure has risen to try to regulate this sector, it's gotten more and more dangerous. And so you have a handful of activists and journalists and who try to make it a priority, but they do so at great personal risk. And there's a little, really, you know, very little recourse, even if you catch someone in the act of logging an area illicitly. There's not a ton that you can do, and unfortunately, oftentimes the violence is not far behind in those situations, and that's been the truth for many activists. I think the figure that's often cited is that there have been 650 attacks in the last handful of years in relation to illegal logging incidents. And you know, the real number is certainly much higher than that. I even in my own reporting, we had to make a quick escape. We had to flee at some point. And I talked to people who, you know, who had been threatened, you know, with an axe even in the last handful of days. And it's pretty much common practice at this point.
Just to give a couple examples before we go to break, in 2015, you write about Romanian environmentalist Gabriel Pan, who was beaten unconscious by loggers in an ambush caught on camera. And even though this was caught on a film, his attackers remain free to this day.
That's right. Yeah. And I spoke with him, you know, at pretty length about that attack. And I've actually seen the video. It's extremely jarring to see it. And yeah, I met up with him in Bucharest as part of my reporting trip there. And this was in late 2021. And he was still delivering evidence to the prosecutor with the hope they would bring charges at some point. You know, this was more than 6 years down the line. He was getting CT scans and various other, you know, medical work done on him to prove the extent of the damage, which was quite severe. And he's, you know, been living in hiding more or less ever since, and, you know, left Romania to protect himself. And those stories are actually not uncommon. There was another environmentalist who I read about the piece named Tiberiu Bosutar, who was attacked in September of 2021. And he ended up going to Bucharest to hide out fearing for his life. And then when he returned to his hometown up in the northeast province of Suceava, he was routinely tailed by cars that he assumes were loggers or people in the logging industry. And it's a very dangerous enterprise.
Wow. And you actually start your story by talking about these two Bucharest-based documentary filmmakers who were shattering Tiberiu. And I mean, this is a harrowing story, so many visuals in this. And I'll ask you to talk about that after a quick break. Today, we are spending the hour with Alexander Salmon. He wrote a really important piece for the New Republic called IKEA's Race for the Last of Europe's Old Growth Forest. The furniture giant is hungry for Romania's famed trees and little stands in its way. Alexander reports that Romania is home to one of the largest and most important old growth forests left in the world. In 2015, the furniture giant IKEA bought 83,000 acres of forest in Romania. Within months, IKEA became and remains Romania's largest private landowner. It's now the largest individual consumer of wood in the world, its appetite growing by 2 million trees every single year. According to some estimates, it sources up to 10% of its wood from the relatively small country of Romania and has relationships with mills and manufacturers in the region. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are spending the hour with Alexander Salmon, a former reporter and researcher at The New Republic, who's now a staff writer at The American Prospect. He's out with a piece in the New Republic called IKEA's Race for the Last of Europe's Old Growth Forest. So before the break, we were just talking about how it's pretty much up to activists to protect these forests. Many have been beaten. Some have lost their lives. And you tell your piece. I mean, you tell a harrowing story about these two Bucharest-based documentary filmmakers who were shattering Tiberiu Bosutar. It's Mihai Dragolia is a director and Radu Mocanu is a cameraman. Can you tell us more about what happened on this day? I mean, like I said, it's just harrowing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, Mihai and Radu, two filmmakers working on a project about the illegal wood trade. So, you know, obviously this topic is something that's important to Romanians as well. And they were shadowing this activist named Tiberiu. He's someone who has a pretty substantial following online. He has a Facebook page and kind of built a reputation for accosting loggers who were engaged in illegal logging. He would chase down trucks that were stuffed with illegal wood, and he would often stream these interactions on Facebook Live because he wanted to, you know, basically as a sort of citizen journalist type of venture. And given how little, you know, formal enforcement there is, this has been something that he's done for a handful of years. He actually, you know, was once someone who worked in the forestry sector, and he was a wood chipper and went to forestry high school. So he knows the industry well and had sort of a conversion and became an environmentalist. But these two filmmakers were following him. They had 4 days basically of shadowing him. And on the final day, they had gotten tipped off that there was this illegal clear cut that they should go investigate. And they chose to, and they picked up actually the tipster, which is a local villager who had messaged him on Facebook. They picked him up, and the four of them went to this site where they did indeed, of course, encounter, you know, illegal logging. They saw these stumps. They saw this area that had been totally clear cut. And at that point, they decided they would call the forest ranger, try to, you know, engage in a dialogue about what had happened and kind of get it all on camera to see how this process works. When they put in the call, the group that eventually showed up was not forest ranger or the police or anyone they expected. It was actually two SUVs full of loggers and the forest engineer. And they basically ambushed Tiberio and the two documentarians. They, you know, were wielding bats and axes, and they charged them and ended up beating two of them unconscious. Tiberio, they stripped his clothes off and they took pictures of him and posted them online. The way that they described the attack to me later on was basically that, you know, they almost tortured him effectively. Oh. And, you know, I think it's not an exaggeration to say that they effectively attempted to kill him. And eventually, you know, one of the two filmmakers was able to call 911 or the local equivalent, and eventually emergency services did arrive and took two of them took all three of them to the hospital. You know, I think four of the 15 attackers ended up getting arrested. The charges that they ended up facing were brawling, which is a, you know, very light charge. All four of them were out on bail by within 24 hours. And the bail system is different there, but, you know, it's the sort of thing where impunity is pretty much the standard. And even in this case, which was, you know, it was well known. It was, you know, journalists and activists, and within 72 hours, basically, they were free. The story had basically moved on. And yeah, it was a chilling, you know, obviously a very chilling tale, chilling for me too, because it happened actually the first day that I'd arrived in Romania, and I was planning to go into the forest myself with an activist, one who worked undercover primarily. And, you know, I wasn't sure what the point of the sort of undercover aspect of this was, but, you know, that made it very clear very quickly that, you know, that we need to take the utmost precautions doing this reporting and doing this work.
And it's so sad because the message this sends to activists, documentary filmmakers, journalists, when you spoke with Tiberiu, he fled to Bucharest and said, this is not the first time I've had an attempt on my life. It's been three or four times already that I've been attacked. Do I simply admit that this is a failed state, that I don't have an ally within it? I don't know what I should do. And then he started to cry. I mean, it's just so sad because they're trying so hard, and yet look at what they're up against.
Right, absolutely. And Tiberiu, to his credit, is an extremely tough guy. I mean, just he's wearing, when I met him, he was wearing a, you know, this leather jacket, and he had, you know, obviously this black eye and you know, he's bruised all over, and I mean, he's the sort of guy that if you saw him, you wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't think to mess with him, and you know, someone who really has really very noble intentions in a lot of ways, and to see him, you know, in that state, and to see how, you know, how frightened he was, how fearful he was. And it was, you know, it was really arresting and moving and tragic in so many ways. And yeah, it was certainly it was a very, very moving interview, was speaking with him.
I bet. Tell us a little bit about your encounter with Andre last September to investigate logging in protected old growth. Andre was in the last leg of a 17-day trip that had taken him to the far corners of the country.
Yeah, and so Andre, I should say, is not his real name. This was one of the sort of protections that we had to take to ensure that he, you know, wasn't exposed for his research or put in danger. And he was doing a report to the European Union. So the European Commission has taken, obviously, or, you know, for various reasons, which we can get into, has taken a real interest in these forests. Obviously, they appreciate how dire the situation is, and they've tried to, you know, compel Romania to do enforcement, to do protection, but that hasn't happened. And so the research that Andrei was doing was basically going to areas where satellite imaging had suggested that there had been logging in old growth forests in the last 12 months and trying to get in there, get photo or video evidence of that logging, and then compile it into a report and send it back to the European Commission so they could see basically that the logging in this country has continued unabated despite the attempts of the European Commission to pressure them to curtail it. So he was generous enough to let me tag along with him for the last 3 days of this research trip. And so he and I did three full days of what was a lot of driving, a lot of hiking, a lot of investigating, and a lot of documentation in various parts of the country.
And a lot of looking over your shoulder, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly correct. And that's well put, because as our time together progressed, it actually, you know, got more and more, it felt like basically that the logging interests in these areas were closing in on us in a lot of ways. I've said this a million times, but we took a ton of precautions, and, you know, we tried to go on weekends and afternoons when logging sites wouldn't be active. And, you know, despite all those things, we encountered illegal logging a number of times. We had an encounter with a logger who was on an illicit site that we had to flee. And we had another encounter that was also illegal logging in an IKEA-owned forest that resulted in a confrontation that didn't get violent, but was still certainly frightening. And looking over your shoulder is exactly right. That if I could even describe my role in this, that's more or less what it was to keep my head on a swivel and scan for any potential danger or confrontation.
Wow. And then on this trip, again, sadly, you got drone footage showing so much clear cutting near 500-year-old trees and dense forests.
That's right. Yeah. It's, you know, I think the photos and the videos that we were able to obtain, you know, show it pretty clearly, but it's a jarring experience. You know, you hike, you drive on these logging roads, and then you get out and you hike, and you often go through these very densely forested areas that are so beautiful. And then you either arrive at a clearing where everything has been decimated, or you launch the drone, which is, you know, more or less how we're doing this research. And you see that on all sides of you are these clear cuts, or these areas where all that's left is, you know, either brown soil or, you know, weeds or branches or, you know, just the total devastation of this, these forest lands. And it's really startling, and you get a sense of it. I mean, it happens so routinely that you almost get desensitized to it, but it was, you know, so commonplace. And basically everywhere we went, we encountered stuff that we had either were expecting to see, or that was much worse than we had expected. And it was illuminating in some sense, but also incredibly discouraging in another.
Mm. Today, we're speaking with Alexander Salmon about his piece, IKEA's Race for the Last of Europe's Old Growth Forest. He wrote this for The New Republic. He's a former reporter and researcher with The New Republic, and he's now a staff writer at The American Prospect. Bringing this back again to IKEA devours 1% of the world's timber annually, with a particular regional reliance on Romania and its surrounds. And again, IKEA is not only the largest furniture company in the world, according to your reporting, but the largest buyer and retailer of wood. You quoted Tara Ganesh, head of timber investigations at the UK-based NGO EarthSight, who said IKEA's growth really goes hand in glove with the forestry sector in Eastern Europe and Russia.
That's right. Yeah. And so it's interesting, you know, that's obviously, that was a deliberate choice that was made on their behalf, was to source from this particular part of the world. And obviously there are large forests in places like Indonesia and Brazil. And, you know, we see a lot of very sort of exploitative extractive industry, you know, setting up shop in those places. IKEA, you know, chose this part of the world for for its operations. And so as they've grown, as they've gotten bigger and bigger and more popular, that's meant that the strain on this particular part of the world has gotten similarly extreme.
We talked about this subcontracting and the supply chain earlier, but this is really important because you write, when someone in the chain gets busted for using illicit or unsustainable sourcing, like if a factory that makes folding chairs is popped for sourcing timber from a legally protected forest in Poland, for example, IKEA can simply distance itself and claim ignorance. And that's what it does?
That's right. Yeah. So IKEA has relationships with these, you know, companies that manufacture, you know, various pieces for them. And, you know, all of these manufacturers are, you know, they're certified as sustainable manufacturers. And if they do get busted for using illegal wood, which happens routinely, IKEA can say, well, that's not us. That's, you know, we don't own them. We, you know, we work with them, but that's their problem, really. And it's just, it doesn't accurately describe what goes on. A number of these manufacturers work exclusively with IKEA or almost exclusively. In my own reporting, I found that oftentimes they even have the same color schemes. The blue and yellow is even visible on Google Earth. You can see, or they'll fly the Swedish flag, which is, you know, kind of funny for a factory based in Romania to be doing. And so, you know, these are very close relationships, and the fact that they're not explicitly owned by IKEA gives them a degree of plausible deniability when they get busted for illegal sourcing or you know, unsustainable practices. But of course, that happens basically all the time. If you know, if you look closely enough, if you bother to follow the chain closely, you're going to see that happen. And of course, you know, there's very little in terms of consequence down the line for these manufacturers or for IKEA when that does happen.
Based on the interviews you did, what can be done about this?
It's a really good question. It actually, in some sense, is an existential question for the European Commission and the European Union, because the EU has, you know, they have strong environmental commitments on climate change, but also on biodiversity. And one of their top priorities is this diversity strategy for 2030. And one of the key enforcement mechanisms for that is this Natura 2000 protected ecosystem program, where certain landscapes that have outstanding value to biodiversity are supposed to be protected. And a lot of the forests that I visited in my reporting were Natura 2000 sites. And those are supposed to be basically off limits for logging of almost any sort. And despite that, obviously there's logging of all types. It's basically the Wild West, despite that protection. And so the EU has a serious credibility problem on its own hands, which is that, you know, it's saying it's this, you know, this government agency that is able to enact changes, to enforce standards, to commit to various, you know, policy prescriptions, and yet it is unable to protect these forests at the current moment. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens. They are in the process of, I think they've held Romania in contempt for its inability to protect these regions, but you know, its own power is limited. They can't make the law for Romania, but something will certainly come of this. And I think that, you know, the research that Andre was doing while I was with him was part of that process. In terms of what can be done on an individual level or as a consumer, there's not a lot. I mean, you know, it's one of these things that you're never going to know whether the folding chairs you bought from IKEA or the bed frame is, you know, sourced sustainably or you know, is made out of wood that was illegally cut from a, you know, a grove of 400-year-old spruce. But the one, I think, you know, the one sort of thing that I came to in my thinking about this is that the best thing you can do is try to buy things that are going to last. And so getting disposable furniture is obviously just not a sustainable method no matter what. If you can buy things that you're going to have for multiple years, or you can buy things secondhand, or you can buy things that are going to be part of your life for, you know, more than just a handful of months, that can make as big a difference as some of this other stuff. But yeah, it's hard not to feel a sense of futility about how to take this issue head on, because so far, you know, no one's really been able to.
Right. We're just all so connected to this global system, and it's so hard to disconnect. Well, I hope you can take the time to read Alexander Salmon's piece, IKEA's Race for the Last of Europe's Old Growth Forest. The furniture giant is hungry for Romania's famed trees, and little stands in its way. Alexander Salmon is a former reporter and researcher at the New Republic and is now a staff writer at the American Prospect. And before we let you go, Alexander, I'd love to talk with you about one of your recent pieces, really important information, a look inside the Interior Department. And let's just spend about 5 minutes on this. You report that the nomination of Deb Haaland as the Biden administration Secretary of the Interior was, pushed by progressive groups, widely celebrated by Native people as the first Native person to ever head up the department. This just got so much attention, deservedly so. And you also write that her track record on environmental issues really looked like a paradigm shift. So nearly a year into Deb Haaland's confirmation, what have you found?
It's been a pretty disappointing year. I mean, I think that it's hard to slice it any other way. I think there, in some sense, it's actually shocking how this has played out, because, as you said, right, that the nomination of Deb Haaland was maybe the single biggest triumph for progressives in terms of staffing the Biden cabinet, and having a Native woman in charge of a department that has, historically run roughshod over Indigenous people's rights, and certainly had a very, very little concern for, environmental issues and climate change. It's really been a clearinghouse for oil and gas sector. This seemed like a serious paradigm shift. And a year into this so far, the Biden Interior Department has approved 34% more oil and gas drilling permits than the Trump administration did in its first year. They've granted almost 3,600 concessions in just the first 12 months. The majority of those actually even came in Deb Haaland's own home state of New Mexico, which is even more shocking. And there were some headlines at the end of the year about this auction of the offshore drilling permits for the Gulf of Mexico, which was the biggest lease sale that had ever happened. And that was pretty shocking as well. And, there's been continued push to move on Arctic drilling. And it's just not the sort of thing you would have expected, I think, a year ago, that the Biden administration would actually be worse on oil and gas drilling in public lands than the Trump administration had been. But unfortunately, that's pretty much the case.
And this is why your reporting is so important, because you write that the Biden White House remains chock full of holdovers from previous Democratic administrations, ones like Obama's and Clinton's, that prioritized placing nice with fossil fuel industries. And these advisors have won out over the early pledges from President Biden to reconsider their relationship to leasing and to take climate change seriously. So can you just tell us, you wrote about a top-level aide like David Hayes, and then Tommy Baudreau. So tell us first about David Hayes.
Yeah, sure. So Hayes is someone who actually came up through the Clinton administration. He had experience in the Interior Department then. He came back to Interior during the Obama administration. So this is someone with a lot of experience. He's a serious holdover from a bygone era of Democratic politics. And he is serving as special assistant to the president for climate policy, so kind of under the guise of climate related decision making, but someone who's very, very close to the oil and gas industry. And given that tenure both under Clinton and under the Obama administrations, was someone who worked basically hand in glove with the sector to expand. Both administrations expanded oil and gas, really, the Obama administration in particular, but both in the Gulf of Mexico and in the Arctic. And he's someone who, has this track record, has been around for a long time in the service of that undertaking, and is now back in the Biden White House and is a close aide to the president. So one of the important people who is kind of whispering in Biden's ear and has been, at least as my reporting indicated, been kind of able to override any sort of climate-oriented program that Interior might have otherwise pursued.
Today, we're speaking with Alexander Salmon about his piece, IKEA's Race for the Last of Europe's Old Growth Forest. He wrote this for The New Republic. He's a former reporter and researcher with The New Republic, and he's now a staff writer at The American Prospect. You also write about Tommy Boudreau, who is Biden's Deputy Secretary of the Interior. He was confirmed in June. He's an Obama holdover. Another oil and gas ally, the Center for Biological Diversity, described him as a rubber stamp for drillers, even in the period after Deepwater, the Deepwater Horizon. He was actually charged with the establishment of an intense regulatory environment for deepwater drilling. So it's so interesting because you look at the people who are the faces of the Interior Department, for example. There are some other departments that are headed now by Native people. And yet, based on your reporting, the people who are making the decisions are holdovers who are friendly to oil and gas. I mean, if that's the case, and that's the case based on what you reported, what can climate activists do at this point?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it's such a cynical move to do this. And yeah, you know, you have the sort of first Native head of the Army Corps of Engineers. You have the first Native head of the Department of Interior. You have, a Indigenous person leading the National Park Service. Like, these were all, you know, grand gestures. And I think meaningful ones to make those decisions at the top of these organizations that have historically done next to nothing for Indigenous rights and also been pretty troubling on climate. But then, yeah, then to staff these other positions that actually have more power with the same people who've been, you know, making those decisions to ally themselves with oil and gas to make things as favorable as possible for industry and to empower those people while riding out the sort of favorable news coverage about these historic appointments. You know, it's a very cynical decision. And I think it's something that's really troubling in a lot of ways and certainly for climate activists. I think that, you know, keeping the pressure on the Biden administration is really the best thing that can happen. I mean, the Biden administration has shown in various ways that it is susceptible to public pressure and to the spotlight. If there's enough pressure placed on it, it'll reverse course. And I think that what pressure has been put on them about oil and gas leasing has been, you know, somewhat successful here and there. The courts have also been surprisingly helpful in kind of slowing down the oil and gas leasing binge. But, you know, I think that this is almost in a lot of ways a first step in getting these sort of the reality of what's going on inside the White House out there, kind of, I think, can inform activists on how best to proceed going forward.
You just reminded me of the people versus fossil fuels mobilization that was led by Native people in October, 5 days of events, a ton of arrests, hardly any media coverage. And Joy Braun, a Native activist you interviewed, also came on our show. She was arrested and, you know, just talked about her experience seeing grandmothers arrested. It's like you said, it is so cynical. What stood out for you when you interviewed Joy Braun about this?
You know, her frustration, she had a sense of knowing frustration, I think, which is, you know, I think for someone who's, you know, been in this space for a while, someone who's intimately involved with this, she wasn't surprised, right? You're never going to be caught flat-footed when you know the nature of how the industry works and how especially in, you know, people in government who have close relationships with the industry, how they operate. And so, you know, she, for certain things it seemed shocking to me, you know, she was like, it's terrible. You know, it's no surprise though. It's bad, but it's not shocking. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, she has a very sober and honest assessment of where we're at and where we've been on climate. And I think a lot of, you know, a lot of Democrats generally have had a hard time even assessing honestly, the track record of Democratic administrations. And so, you know, under Obama, we, you know, the Obama administration really, really drastically expanded oil and gas drilling. And that was one of the true legacies of Obama's presidency. And it's tough to grapple with that, I think, on some level. And the idea that things might be changing, obviously Biden on the campaign trail said one thing and did another, but, you know, it seems kind of like it's gotten back into this sort of same old state of affairs, which is, I think, is frustrating, disappointing for a lot of reasons.
Alexander Salmon is a staff writer at the American Prospect, and you can find his piece, A Look Inside Interior, Biden Appointed Native Americans to Top Jobs at the Cabinet Agency. But so far, the Interior Department's policies have been business as usual. Find that at yourcallradio.org. Alexander, thanks so much for your great reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, Dr. Thomas Insel will be back to discuss healing, our path from mental illness to mental health. In 2015, when Dr. Insel was director of the National Institute of Mental Health, an encounter he had with the parent of a 23-year-old with schizophrenia caused him to leave his job to investigate why our mental health system is broken, not as a psychiatrist, but as a journalist in search of solutions. Join the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.